Zadie and I are now going to talk a little bit, just completely naturally standing up here
stunning,
so close to each other.
The way you do.
So I want to start with kind of, I guess, the dreaded process question, but I wanted to read something from a beautiful essay, The I Who Is Not Me. Mm. And in the essay you say, I am someone who likes to be in control when I write, who prefers to believe she is making basically impersonal and rational aesthetic choices. So that is so contrary to my shtick, which is that I try to know nothing. So could you tell me a little bit, what does that mean? What does control feel like in that moment?
It's so weird that you chose that quote. That was true. That has been true of me my whole life. But I really, and honestly, partially taking you as a model, have been trying not to do that anymore. So I've been writing stories and really trying to have some faith in not knowing things, mm-hmm. or not knowing anything.
And you just finished the book of stories.
I just finished it. And a lot of it was reading your stories, reading Grace Paley, reading mm-hmm. Donald Barthelme, and just seeing that, or Barthelme, who knows, I never know. But just the freedom of those stories, you know, mm-hmm. the freedom of the shape and not knowing where you're going to end up when you begin. And The Lazy River was a bit like that. Like I think it was a thing of youth that I wanted to control all the areas so as not to look a fool. But I don't mind looking a fool anymore.
Do you imagine you could write a novel in that mindset?
I don't know how.
Yeah,
I don't think I could. It would have to be very short.
I can give you advice, which is a lot of white space. that's what I did, and it worked really well. Yeah.
But can I ask a counter question?
Yes.
Like, with Lincoln and Bardo, it seems so woven and constructed. You must have known.
You know what I actually knew was two things. One was Lincoln is going to come in, hold the body, and leave.
Right.
And Willie is either going to go to heaven or not. That was the outline for about 3 years. And then, but that was more certainty than I would usually have in a story. That was like a big outline to me.
Yeah.
And then the fun of it was to sort of graft on, you know, the doilies, kind of like, okay, so what is, how does he get there? But it was very similar to the story where you would say, all I know is he's got to cross this part of the graveyard, but I don't know what he's going to find on the way. And that was the moment, I've been talking to a lot of artists about this vanishing of self that happens sometimes. And for me, that happens at that moment when you say, okay, I'm walking northwest across the graveyard, and then just a little quieting down of your mind, and then something comes in, mm-hmm. in this case, a ghost. But you would sort of say, you wouldn't say, what ghost do I need? You would kind of say, which ghost is there, which is primarily a verbal reef. Does that ring a bell at all with what you...
I don't plan in the sense of, plot structure. I was always struck by, when I was very young, seeing a page of Virginia Woolf's diaries where she planned Mrs. Dalloway, which is, it's just like six bullet points, and it literally says things like, wakes up, goes for walk, park, Septimus, the end. In her mind, that was the structure of that book, and she let herself move between those points. But I guess I think about it, the analogy I always use is like with music. If I were in a jazz band singing jazz, everybody is aware of the chords, right, when you're playing Autumn Leaves. And then you have this freedom between the chords and between the notes. But I'm quite fixed. I've always had quite fixed positions, you know? So that the novels turn out essayistic in one way or another. So for me, short stories are just freedom, because there isn't enough room for that kind of, for the chord structure.
I was out there a little bit like a joke. Like, you know, you get to the end of a joke, and there's either laughter or there's not.
Right.
And if there's not, you lose, you know. And, and I heard Linda Berry, this writer, say that they had done brain scans of people, and people who had read a short lyric poem, a joke, or a short story, the same thing happened, which is an instantaneous micro-examination of structure. So if you do that and your brain says, shapely, then you laugh or you're pleased. And if it says, oh, there's a six-page diversion when the duck walks into the bar, then you don't laugh.
Right.
You know?
I think the hardest thing for me is learning not to knit everything to the next piece. And actually living with a poet, primarily a poet, helps a lot, and particularly when I read my husband's last collection, just noticing the gaps between lines, the gaps between ideas, the gaps between poems, the way those things speak, just gaps, just pause, the idea of fragments. I really grew up in a literary culture, or at least attended to one end of literary culture, which was all about maximalization, everything put together perfectly in an enormous cake of a novel. And it took me a long time to unlearn a lot of things, you know, that you don't, you know, even the simple thing you tell a student, like to get a person from this side of the room to the other, you don't have to narrate every single step, you know, before they put their hand on the door. I wasn't doing that, but I was doing some version of that. Like every sentence has to move musically and beautifully to the next one, and not recognizing the use of silence, ugliness, sudden stops, all of that stuff, I find very liberating now.
I can't wait to read them.
We'll see.
This piece that you just read was incredible. The way it sort of spanned philosophy and a real moment and beauty and everything. It's just like, I'm like, dang.
I think I'm like more, I know you love Chekhov and Kafka and your own stories, like just more interested in fable as a place where people can enter in together. Like there's an obsession in fiction, or the kind I guess I grew up with, on personal experience and the authenticity of that, you know. Right. And I don't, first of all, I kind of experience myself as a totally inauthentic person, so there's problem number one. And secondly, I like the idea of fable as a place where lots of people can enter, you know. I noticed when John Cameron was reading your story, there were two children in the front row, and they were laughing as hard as any PhD candidate in the audience. To me, that's what a fable involves. It allows access at many different points.
They were laughing to a certain point. So I don't really want to go there, you know what I mean by there, but I do, in this book, one of the themes that kept coming up is, and kind of reconvincing me that of the power of fiction in a difficult time, the power of good writing in a difficult time. And the book not only says that, but it, as I said, it demonstrates it. I literally was pleased to find out that this thing I've been talking about all my life, which is that fiction can change your mind, and writing can change your mind, it did it. I was, a week ago, a little dead to language and a little bit sick of our country, and I read this, and I could feel day-to-day my hope coming back. So do you, first of all, does it matter to you that we think fiction might be helpful in this time? And second of all, can you kind of reiterate how is it meant to be helpful?
Were you there? I'm trying to think if you were there with a conversation with maybe Foster Wallace and Franzen about John Gardner. Do you remember that one?
I would love to have been there.
But it was an argument about John Gardner, who wrote a lot about the morality of fiction. And I guess when we were coming up, that idea was very out of fashion, right? It was kind of considered this moralizing tedium. And even though his book is, Gardner's books on fiction are beautiful, I think. I suppose I went through a period of thinking that, like, it's easy to think that a novel is a kind of trick, right? Because I'm the boss, I organize all the pieces, I set the moral, I make you feel certain ways. It's like being Barnum or something. And you feel that there's something deceitful in it. But something I remember you saying about a story being like a room that you enter, and the way you move in it, you're changed by being in that room. I don't know it from being a writer, but I absolutely know it from being a reader. Like, it is perfectly obvious to me, even if I can be snooty about moralistic theories of fiction, that I have been made by books entirely from childhood, maybe even more than my kind of familial and personal relationships. They've taught me very basic things like how to be good, what goodness might mean. It's not a perfect system, because you're still a failing human, and you still make all the same mistakes after reading Anna Karenina. But the framework exists for me from these books, from the books I've read. So I believe in it in that sense, because I know it to be true, and I think I've become less less shy of that purpose of fiction, because it in this moment it's so useful to me to read. Like, I do find it kind of life-saving on the day-to-day.
You also mentioned in the same essay this notion that there's something really important about just even the fakery of making a person remember that they can be a different person, or they could have been a different person. And I guess what I want to ask is there, and I ask it because I get asked it, is there a limit to that? In other words, the one of the embedded ideas of fiction is that anybody can connect with anybody else, that scale between you and Anna Karenina or you and whoever is continuous. And yet we know from real life that there are people beyond that who maybe aren't connectable. Does that...
It's about contingency, as in what is true, but not necessarily true. And that, I think, includes almost everything. But it means, like, I was reading a lovely book by my colleague at NYU, Antonia Paya, about identity. And he feels very strongly that we can free ourselves of these kind of very fixed and consolidated identities and move around the world. But he's also aware that as a kind of upper middle class, globalized academic, it's easier for him to do that. Right. I think you have to make a difference between how easy it is to do and the ideal. Like, one critique of that theory of Anthony's is, well, it's all very well for you, Mr. Professor. Mm. And that's absolutely a fair critique of class and his situation. But the ideal that one should be able to feel freely within one's identity, be able to make connections between you and others, that should still be the ideal, even if our actual realities make it more and more difficult. I think what worries me is that the ideal is now held in contempt as a kind of fantasy in the first place. And I don't find that to be true, even though I'm aware that many people picking up a book like Anthony's would be, well, this is not my situation. I'm a very particular person in a certain condition, oppressed in a certain way, poor in a certain way, in a very different country from yours, et cetera, et cetera. But nothing about contingency is absolute, as far as I'm concerned. It can be changed. And if it can't be, then there's no point in politics or literature, because the whole purpose is the possibility of change.
Right. And also in that process, as you say, it doesn't have to, you don't have to literally become the other person.
No.
You have to feel the approximation. It's like that commercial that used to be, I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV.
Right.
Like, I'm not Anna Karenina, but I kind of was for a minute. You know,
it doesn't have to be total, the alignment.
Right, right.
And that's between reader and writer too. No, when you think about these questions about who can tell whose story, I always think of Madame Bovary. I mean, what is that apart from an incredible act of drag? You know, it's a man writing an interior of a woman's life, and this interior woman's life, which is by definition fake, he is not a woman, has been so affecting to millions of women around the world for so long. Mm-hmm. What is that relation? It's not authentic. It's the very definition of inauthentic, but it's meaningful.
Right.
So those kind of experiences are ones that I want to defend.
And the other thing I think is related, I heard you on the New Yorker podcast, and you said something, this was probably 4 years ago, and it's never gone out of my mind in the political moment. You were talking about someone that you know and love who is on the opposite end of the political spectrum. And I think the question was, well, how do you relate to this person? And you said, and I hope you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but that basically you have to imagine that there is not a fixed self, and that any individual contains thousands of selves.
Right.
So we have the option of concentrating on the self, in this case, the loving family member, that allows us to retain our own humanity. Is that an approximation of it?
I mean, that's the principle. Of course, putting it in practice, as we all know, is incredibly hard. It's incredibly hard at Thanksgiving. It's incredibly hard at Christmas.
Especially if the person's a real idiot.
Yeah, you know, it's hard. But I do feel more and more, why is it necessary for your opinion to align exactly with mine? That's not necessary for our human relation at every moment. Not in every situation we find ourselves in. And there used to be, when I first came to America, I felt there was this kind of, seems like a million years ago now, but this basic politeness in American life where you were quite often in situations with people in completely different political stripe than you, but they were always civil. There was this kind of, it was a comedy version of it, the fake American civility. Everyone says, have a nice day, right? Even if they're thinking, I hope you die. But I miss that civility now, that everyday kind of American fake politeness or whatever it was, which said we're still humans in relation to each other, even though you're Republican, it's fine.
Right.
That seems to have faded somewhere.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Especially online. I think in real life, maybe not, at the rest stop,
in real life,
not so
it's
much.
Still there.
But yeah. Well, I think we have to take a pause,
sorry.
Unfortunately, but I could go on. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.